Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Russ Ferguson was appointed last March by Donald Trump to be the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, but the Senate didn't get around to confirming his nomination until December. And although Ferguson has been on the job since his nomination, he was finally sworn in on Christmas Eve. We spoke to Russ Ferguson in May, just months after his appointment. Since then, he and his office of 100 assistant U.S. attorneys have been dealing with numerous cases, including the murder of Irina Zarutska on the Blue Line, and most recently, the arrest of a Mint Hill man accused of planning an ISIS-style attack in that town on New Year's Eve. Well, now that he has the job officially, we thought it'd be a good time to check back in with Russ Ferguson, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome back. Good morning.
Well, thanks for having me back. Good morning.
What took so long? How does this process work? So I'm just curious about this. The president comes in and he nominates all these different people in different positions. He can't possibly know all these people. So how did your name float to the surface? And once you got the nomination and you were ensconced in the job, what took the Senate so long to approve you?
Yeah, it was a little different for me. So I actually got an interim U.S. attorney position in March. It was appointed by the attorney general instead of the president. And that's a four-month position. And it ends at 4 months. But the statute allows the court to extend it if they want to. And I'm very fortunate all the district court judges here agreed to extend my appointment. And that's indefinite. So I was in the office acting as U.S. attorney 4 months in, doing everything I need to do. The president actually appointed me at the end of July and sent my nomination to the Senate. And the Senate really does do their due diligence. Like, you think it's a rubber stamp, but I got a whole lot of questions I had to respond to in writing. Everything. They would ask me about my press conferences I had done and what I meant by different statements, about articles I had written when I was in college or in high school. I mean, they go back and look at everything you've done. They ask about your resume, your jobs. They ask your views on certain things and how your priorities for the office and all sorts of things that and individual senators will send you questions. So you're getting questions from the right and the left and you know, responding to those under oath. So you've got to tell the truth in them. And that's a long process. And then, of course, the Senate has their rules, and there's a certain amount of time for debate and all sorts of things. And I think it took four votes for me to get there, because you had a cloture vote, a vote to consider a number of nominees together, a cloture vote on that package, and then a nomination package. So all that took a lot of time, and I was very fortunate the confirmation came through at the end of December.
But in the meantime, you just keep your bags packed just in case they say no?
You know, and I still do, Mike. I mean, I could be fired at any moment, and that's how I operate the job. Do the right thing and be ready to go.
So you are one of 90, as I understand it, 94 U.S. attorneys around the country, and North Carolina has three, because we're broken into three districts: the Eastern District, the Middle District, and your district, the Western District of North Carolina. Why do we have three when some states have none?
Yeah, that's a good question. And what you find is a lot of the older states on the East Coast have more districts than the West Coast. Okay. I think that's because early on, that's just kind of how they split it up. The U.S. attorney's offices really track the federal courts. And so we had three federal court districts. And so we have three U.S. attorney's offices.
And each of these districts around the country, once again, as I understand it, specialize in various aspects of the law, or they seem to. The Southern District of Florida focuses on international crime and money laundering. The Northern District of Illinois focuses on organized crime and political corruption. I wonder why. The District of Columbia focuses on federal crimes. The Southern District of New York is the watchdog for Wall Street and major financial institutions, along with corruption and terrorism. What's the focus of our district, the Western District?
Yeah, and we all really do it all. Those districts become specialized because that's the type of cases they have and the types of defendants they have. So, like you said, in Chicago, there was a lot of organized crime, so they became an expert in that. In Miami, there is a lot of international crime and a lot of drugs coming in from other places, so they become an expert in that. But every district does every federal crime. And so here in Charlotte, I think we're a little mini Southern District of New York. We're the second largest financial center, so we have very sophisticated white-collar prosecutors and have had some very significant white-collar crimes. But we're also right here on – we're about – exactly halfway between Miami and New York. And so we get a lot of drugs coming through here and a lot of gang activity and a lot of interstate crime that happens to cross through here and we get. And I think we're an expert on that.
Yeah.
On interstate.
Well, and we've done programs about how the intersection of 85 mm-hmm. and 77, particularly 85, seems to be a thoroughfare for drugs and human trafficking and other things
exactly.
that you go after. It would seem that there's a lot more than we know about, is there?
I think so, and I think there's a lot more than I know about. I mean, there's a lot of criminals out there, and the very best ones are very hard to catch. But I think there's a lot going on. A lot of it is kind of kept from the public because we kind of topple it like dominoes or like a house of cards. And when you get one defendant, you don't necessarily want to let other people who have interacted with that defendant know that you have that defendant because he may have access
right.
to other people and not just here in Atlanta or in Mexico or in Honduras or wherever his connections are.
And these districts around the country, some of them are more powerful apparently or viewed as more powerful than the others. The Southern District of New York is often referred to as the sovereign district of New York because of their tradition of independence and their aggressive approach to cases. I'm not sure how that happened or why it's allowed to continue. And the Eastern District of Virginia is known as the Rocket Docket mm-hmm. because they handle cases relatively expediently, high-stakes prosecutions going through very quickly. How did that all come to be?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is court-driven. I mean, in the Southern District of New York and geography-driven, the Southern District of New York has Wall Street. So
yeah.
they get a lot of cases. They have a lot of population, but they also have a lot of judges. So they could take a lot of cases. In the Eastern District of Virginia, the judges there have decided that they're going to do cases very, very quickly. And you better have everything buttoned up by the time you get to them because you're off to the races. They also are very close to D.C., and so they get a lot of terrorism cases and things like that where people land at the airports in Virginia. And so you kind of get – it's just like any other job. You get this experience and the sophistication from the cases you get.
Right.
A lot of that comes natural ways.
How would you describe our district?
I think our district is rapidly growing. So, you know, if you'd asked me that 20 years ago when Charlotte was a tiny little town, we were you know, a regular district doing – drug cases and things like that. We are a rapidly growing district throughout the district, not just Charlotte, but all the way west. I mean, our population growth is exploding. Our visitors are exploding. I think we're seeing, and it depends where you are, but we're seeing just a rapid growth in crime from other places.
And you've said that the Western District is one that, quote, punches above our weight, and we will continue to deliver justice that is tough, fair, and focused on keeping our communities safe. What do you mean by pushing above our weight?
Well, our office has not grown nearly as fast as the district has. And instead, we've hired some very, very efficient and good prosecutors. And we are doing bigger cases than we should be for the size and sophistication of our office. We're doing more cases, more sophisticated cases. And I'm probably going to get calls what I'm about to say, but I think we have the best trial attorneys in town in my office. And, you know, not a lot of cases go to trial anymore, but we do more than anyone else. And we can efficiently do a trial and move cases through. I've got motivated people, and I think we're punching above our weight.
I alluded to the fact that you were nominated or appointed as a temporary guy by Pam Bondi in March.
Yeah.
And the president nominated you in July, and the Senate finally got around to appointing you in December. And you took the oath of office in an empty courthouse on Christmas Eve.
Yes.
Must have been a very private ceremony.
It was,
the courthouse was closed.
It was very private.
Is that normal? Would you normally have had a crowd of well-wishers there to make this a more high-profile event?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've actually been sworn in three times.
Okay.
Because I had to be sworn in as interim U.S. attorney. And I think I told you last time I got that call on very short notice and walked over to the courthouse. The courthouse was open. There were more people there, but by no means a lot. The second time was when I got appointed by the court, and I was actually at a judicial conference, and the chief judge took me down a hallway by the bathroom and swore me in at the end of the hall. So that was probably the most
glamorous.
Intimate. Yeah, it was very glamorous. And then, of course, this one on Christmas Eve. So they've all been pretty small. I hope to have a formal investiture at some point.
And as I understand it, Judge Frank Whitney swore you in the same courtroom that you used to clerk for him in?
Yes. So it's a ceremonial courtroom there named after Judge Potter. So we didn't use that day to day, but that's where the big stuff was. So it was an honor to be sworn in there for sure.
You recently announced the arrest of an 18-year-old Mint Hill man who allegedly planned to use knives and hammers mm-hmm. to kill people in a grocery store and a fast food location in an ISIS-inspired attack on New Year's Eve in Mint Hill. The FBI had been investigating this individual for a while, evidently, and I'm assuming that your office is going to handle this prosecution.
Yes, that one's ours.
At what point did your office become aware of this individual and what the FBI suspected he might or might not do?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because we first became aware of him when he was 14 years old.
Right.
And he went about the neighborhood dressed in black gear, carrying hammers, threatening to assault his neighbors. He then kind of went quiet. We didn't hear a whole lot until really right before Christmas. I'd say maybe three weeks before Christmas. He got in touch with an NYPD undercover that he thought was ISIS and started talking about his plans for jihad on New Year's Eve. And obviously we surged resources to that to protect the public.
Wow. Yeah, you mentioned FBI first became aware of him when he was 14 years old. And they, at the time, as I understand it, they asked that the court involuntarily commit him for mental evaluation, and the court declined to do so at the time.
That was actually much more recent. They asked for him to be involuntarily committed just a few days before New Year's Eve, and the state magistrate judge declined to do that. And that was after it was public that he was not only planning an attack, but he planned to kill himself by police.
That gets us back to magistrates for just a second. This little—I wasn't planning to ask you this, but as a result of Arena's Law and the tempest surrounding the events that led up to that, it was revealed that magistrates in North Carolina have generally more power than they do in other states and less training and supervision. Is that part of the problem in this case?
Yeah, I mean, magistrates have a very difficult job, and they are not well paid. You do not have to be a lawyer to be a magistrate. And so you kind of get what you get, and they have a lot of discretion, and rightfully so, because you don't – like, let's take involuntary commitment since we're talking about it. You don't want to be able to say, oh, my girlfriend's crazy, commit her and have a right. You know, have someone commit her the day before Christmas. So you do have to have an individualized assessment of it. But they do have a whole lot of discretion. There's very few ways to appeal that up quickly. And so I do think it's an issue in some cases where you get people who just will never go one way or the other. Instead of being fair in each case, they're deciding to go one way.
But if the FBI comes to a magistrate and says, look, this guy's been walking around the neighborhood dressed in black, carrying hammers, threatening to go after his neighbors. Clearly, there's something not right there with that individual. So why would a magistrate decline an opportunity to have that person evaluated for the public safety?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And in this case, especially because you had an 18-year-old who we knew at that time had knives, had hammers, had threatened people, and had threatened to kill himself. So just for his own safety, I think he should have been involuntarily committed. My understanding is the hearing was very short and not substantive. I get the impression they're moving cases very quickly there and perhaps not giving the consideration they should to cases like this. And I wish they would because, you know, there's a lot of people out there that need help. People are not getting the mental health resources they need through the state system. And I really wish that would be something that would be fixed.
So he was on the FBI's radar twice. And you've said that he was under FBI surveillance for days before he was ultimately arrested, but that agents were prepared to arrest him if he left his home with weapons, adding that, quote, at no point was the public in harm's way. Were we just lucky? I mean, would it have been possible for him to fly under the radar or slip through the cracks? And I have 30 seconds.
Well, it's always possible there's something. I think the public should feel comforted and safe from this because there was not one but two undercover agents who encountered this man during his planning stage of his attack. And so while there may be stuff that we don't know about out there, they're out there, they're finding these people. The fact that he encountered two, one with NYPD and one with the FBI, at least makes me feel safe that law enforcement is doing what they should to keep us all safe.
And NYPD, I don't have time to get an answer to this. So I'll wait till after the break for the answer. But the question is, why was NYPD involved in a guy in Mint Hill? We'll talk about that with Russ Ferguson, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Russ Ferguson. He is the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. He's been in that job since March, but he took the oath finally, officially, on Christmas Eve. We were talking before the break about the ISIS-inspired potential attack that was thwarted by the FBI, and you were at the press conference announcing his arrest of this 18-year-old individual in Mint Hill who had planned an ISIS-style attack in Mint Hill at a grocery store and a fast food location. FBI agents executed a search warrant at his home and found handwritten documents, including one entitled New Year's Attack 2026. Pretty damning. At your press conference, you told reporters he had a very well thought out plan. What was he allegedly planning to do?
He was planning to go to a fast food restaurant where he worked and or a grocery store. And he had looked at multiple grocery stores and was going to pick the most crowded one. And he had multiple knives and hammers and was going to go through the grocery store assaulting people, stabbing people, until the police came and shot him.
This is what we're going to talk about the blue line and Irina's law a little bit later on. But one of the impetuses behind this is the lack of public confidence in public safety. But you cannot protect the public against every incident of somebody who's not completely mentally balanced, clearly, from doing something that's completely random, can you?
And indoctrinated. I mean, he had been indoctrinated online by ISIS. And all you can do is exactly what law enforcement did here, have undercovers ready and try to find these people in the planning stages before they do it. Because even if he were unsuccessful, if he got to the grocery store and everyone ran, he couldn't get to anyone, he was going to do that until he was shot by police. And it is terrorism alone to have police come in and be forced to shoot someone in a grocery store on New Year's Eve. I mean, we just can't have
right.
that.
Right.
And so I feel comforted they got him in the planning stages. But, you know, New Year's Eve is a place where there are a lot of crowds and people celebrating the American way of life. And it's a time and place that's ripe for terrorism.
We are given to believe that these incidents are becoming more frequent and that the FBI and other law enforcement have to be vigilant to find these individuals. And I think we're probably lucky that, although I'm sure they have an apparatus to do this, some people are not going to be spotted. Some people might slip through the cracks over time. But they find these people, they follow them, they clearly engage with them using aliases so that they gain their confidence. PBS reports that the FBI has foiled several alleged attacks through sting operations in which agents pose as terror supporters, which was the case in this case, supplying advice and equipment. How frequently is this going on behind the scenes that we don't know about?
I mean, there are agents doing this all the time. And like I said, there was an NYPD agent here or officer here because he was originally planning an attack in New York, as a lot of terrorists do before he switched to Mint Hill. And there was an FBI agent. And the FBI has people committed to this. And so does the Department of Justice. We have lawyers ready to go all the time, both in my office and in Washington, ready to get search warrants or arrest warrants or whatever we need to protect the public. So it's happening probably more often than you think.
It's difficult to believe this, but there are critics who say that these means that the FBI uses to observe and engage with these people is essentially entrapment of mentally ill individuals who would not have the wherewithal to carry out their schemes were it not for the FBI giving them advice and equipment. Mm-hmm. Can that be successfully argued in court?
It's certainly been tried, and we're very cognizant of it. So at the beginning of this investigation, we had lawyers, and not just in my office, but lawyers who specialize in terrorism cases in Washington, D.C., on this case, meeting with the FBI every day to make sure they didn't take any steps that would be entrapment. And we literally were, and part of the reason we took him for, or the FBI took him for involuntary commitment, was to give us time to see if this was real or not without entrapment, and to build that evidence and let him do what he's going to do. So we're very cognizant of that. That is absolutely an argument that can be successful in court. And the FBI is very careful not to entrap people and get the real bad guys.
The Department of Justice is known for not bringing cases forward for indictment that they feel they can't win.
Yes.
The FBI's bringing this individual to a magistrate and asking for him to be involuntarily committed for a period of time is different from that.
For sure.
And it could be abused. how do you fix this so that it's clear to a magistrate or to a judge that this person is a danger to himself and the community, and at least we ought to take a beat here and evaluate their behavior and give them the help they may need if they in fact need it, versus just picking somebody at random and saying, okay, involuntarily commit him because he could be trouble.
Right. Just give us time. Yeah. Right. Well, it's very, very rare that the FBI goes into state court at all, much less for involuntary commitment. I think there's a line to be drawn, and the line is evidence of harm to others and certainly evidence of harm to yourself. And I think we had that here. I mean, he was going to stab people in a grocery store. He was going to wait until he was shot by police. I think he should have been involuntarily committed. But what do I know? I mean, maybe he doesn't have any mental issues, and maybe this was an issue for law enforcement. I'm sure all of that will be litigated, and we'll see. You know, it's a testament to what the FBI does to build a case, because at that moment they had that evidence, and they still didn't think they had enough to arrest him. They built more of a case. They executed a search warrant.
And the Observer reports, Charlotte Observer reports, they did a record search on this individual and found that they could not find any prior criminal charges. Your office says he has no prior federal charges. Will any of that play a role in his trial?
Well, keep in mind he was a juvenile until very recently when he turned 18. And so he won't have a public record for anything that happened while he was a juvenile. It will certainly play a role, though. I mean, at sentencing, a federal judge will determine his sentence, assuming he is found guilty. And of course, everything we're talking about today is just allegations, because these are just charges. But if he is eventually found guilty and sentenced, then his criminal history will be one aspect that a judge looks at. And rightly so. I mean, like we often say, everyone deserves a second chance. Not everyone deserves a third. But this is an 18-year-old kid who I think can be rehabilitated.
It's difficult to prove a negative, and he didn't carry anything out.
Yes.
So he may have planned it. He may have had delusions of grandeur, or he may have had every intent to do exactly what he planned to do. But what happens when it doesn't happen? You just catch him before it happens. What happens in that case?
Yeah, well, there is a statute for attempted material support of a terrorist organization, which is what we've charged so far here. And we're still very much in the early stages of this case and may add charges or whatever. But it is much harder to prove an attempt. And you often do have a defense that, no, I wasn't actually going to do it. And part of the reason we really built a case showing that he intended to do it. And we found the knives under the bed. We found the hammers under the bed. We talked to the grandfather he lived with, who said, I don't allow him to have knives in the house. We have the manifesto or the notes that we found where it was meticulously planned. We have the undercovers who he confided in as members of ISIS and said, here's what I'm going to do. So it is harder to build a case, but we would always rather have this case than the case where lives have been lost and we're going back to prosecute someone who did.
Your office is also involved in the prosecution of DeCarlos Brown Jr., who is the man accused of fatally stabbing Irina Zarutska on the Blue Line train in August. Explain why this local crime is being federally prosecuted.
Yeah, that's a great question, and a question I get a lot, because a stabbing is often a state crime. And had that stabbing happened somewhere else, it may have been. But Congress, and shortly after 9/11, I believe, said that, you know, if you're going to have someone who's sitting alone on the Blue Line, going about their day, going back and forth from work, that is randomly stabbed in the back of the neck and killed, that is not only a crime against that person, but it's going to change the whole city, because people are going to be afraid to ride the Blue Line. People are going to be afraid to take it to UNCC to go to their college courses. They're going to be afraid to take it to work. And so that is, in some sense, an act of terrorism. I mean, it's creating terror in the community. And so for that reason, they made it a federal crime. It's also because transit systems are not within the city limits. I mean, the CAT system goes into South Carolina. It goes to the airport. It does intersect with the federal transit system quite a bit. And so there are federal laws to protect people who ride it.
But it's a double prosecution, because he's also been charged by the state and will face state charges and a state trial as well. Do we need two prosecutions for the same crime for the same individual?
Probably not. And this happens all the time where we have a state crime and a federal crime, and generally one will go first, and if successful, the other one will not. Now, the law does allow you to prosecute two. I mean, it's two different crimes. It'd be a first-degree murder in the state court system and this transit charge in our system. But, you know, me and the DA work very closely together, and we generally work these out so that we're treating people fairly.
You have said that the death penalty the federal death penalty is on the table for DeCarlos Brown. There has been a moratorium on the federal death penalty since 2021, but Attorney General Pam Bondi lifted that moratorium in February and directed the DOJ to strengthen the death penalty. What does that mean, strengthen the death penalty?
Yeah, so there's a lot of protections in the law for the death penalty, obviously, because no one takes the decision to pursue the death penalty lightly. The actual decision of whether to pursue the death penalty or not is made by the Attorney General of the United States in every single case.
Okay.
And so I don't know what she means when she says strengthen it, but I think she's signaling that she is not as opposed to it as prior administration.
Except that she has directed the DOJ to strengthen the death penalty. And if you don't know, as an officer of the Department of Justice, what that means, how can you do it?
Well, I think it means the types of cases you take. Take cases where you can get the death penalty, particularly in states where you may not. And that's what the Department of Justice has been doing. And there is a committee in Washington that looks at every case before the Attorney General makes that decision. My office makes a recommendation on every case. And a lot of work goes into that. We give the defendant an opportunity to weigh in on it. We talk to the family of the victims. A whole lot goes into that decision before it is made. But it doesn't take a whole lot to strengthen the death penalty when the prior policy was a moratorium.
Right. Has the death penalty been decided in this case? Have you made a decision yet?
No, and we haven't even made a recommendation yet. Okay. So this case, of course, these are just charges and just allegations, but we will investigate this case fully. And on parallel tracks, we'll do all of what I just said, talk to the family of the victim and all of that and make a recommendation.
If you decide to go in that direction, or whoever makes the decision decides to take it in that direction, will this be the first instance of the federal government seeking the death penalty since the moratorium was lifted, or have there been others already?
I believe there have been others. It'll be the first instance, it'll be the first instance in this district. We have two cases that are eligible for the death penalty now, but a decision is not made in either case yet.
How do you view the death penalty? Do you see it as a deterrent or merely the ultimate punishment for somebody who has committed, in this case, allegedly committed a heinous crime?
Yeah, I do think it is a deterrent. I do. And I know there's differing research on that. I think when you drill down to localities, especially growing localities like this, the death penalty does deter the worst of the worst crimes. But it also serves the victims, I think, in a way. I mean, we have people taking lives every day, and sometimes it helps the victims to know that people may experience the same.
But if a crime as heinous as this is premeditated, if you decided you know the individual and you hate that individual and you targeted that individual and you carry out that act, that's one thing. This was completely random. They never spoke. He didn't know her. She didn't know him. Clearly, something is off there in terms of that of the alleged perpetrator of that crime. And I use the word alleged in quotation marks because we have it on tape. Is that the same thing? Does that deserve the same kind of punishment?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a policy decision, and it's hard to say on a blanket basis, I think. I mean, if you think about the sniper in D.C. who was driving around killing people, that was random. He didn't know anybody. He killed multiple people. Is that different than one premeditated murder? And that's why the death penalty is applied on a case-by-case basis. Okay. And the Supreme Court said a long time ago, if you have a mental health issue, if you're insane, you cannot be subject to the death penalty. So that is a defense. And I don't know that will be the case here. I think we're all hoping he's crazy to do this, but you know, we'll have to see what the evidence is.
This murder triggered many things. It got international attention, and it triggered the passage of Arena's Law by the General Assembly. And among other things, that law creates a new legal category, violent offenses. And this allows unsecured bonds and written promises to appear in those cases. You have to be secured. You have to be in jail. It restarts the death penalty in the state, and also made money available for about 10 more prosecutors that Spencer Merriweather, the district attorney in Mecklenburg County, has been pleading for for years, but not enough. And he wants more than that. He's a guest tomorrow on this program, so we'll talk about that. But critics say it doesn't put money and resources where it is needed most, for more prosecutors, more money for jails, more money for courts, more money for mental health. What's your take on what the impact this law is likely to have.
Yeah, and so Arena's law is a state law. It applies in state court, so it really doesn't apply to our cases.
But you're a lawyer.
In federal court. Yeah, so I've just... I don't deal with it in my job, but I'm happy to talk about it.
You're the only lawyer in the room. I have to ask you.
I think it will help, though. I understand the argument that everyone wants more resources, and obviously more cops and more DAs is going to lower crime. But I do think a lot of the crimes happening are people who are already out on bond, and requiring a secure bond will mean there are fewer people out on bond or more people reporting to court. And a secure bond doesn't necessarily mean they're held in jail. It could be that they have to put money down to go, or their family has to put money down and create some ownership over them to make sure they return to court. Mm-hmm. But if we can lower the recidivism of people who are out on bond, I think we'll lower the caseload for the district attorney's office, which will basically be the same thing as hiring more DAs. It'll be fewer cases per DA prosecuting more cases.
Katz, the Charlotte Mayor of Isle Isles, CMPD's new police chief, who you were recently with, Stella Patterson, have all spoken about the need to increase security on public transportation in particular and the city in general because there is a perceived safety issue with the Uptown Charlotte. Is your office involved in this process in any way aside from, I don't even know what it would be?
No, I wish we were. I wish we were. I mean, the only way we're really involved is taking the cases, and we've taken two of them where there were stabbings on the light rail. But I do think there's a need for more security on the light rail. I think we've got to not only make the light rail safe, but make it feel safe. And I think that could pay for itself. If we just had officers checking tickets on the light rail, the amount of people that are not paying for the light rail, and our most recent stabbing in the light rail, the person had been banned from the light rail, shouldn't have ever been on that train to begin with, and no one enforced the law to take him off the train when he violated that ban. So I think a little bit more law enforcement could pay for itself.
A man named, for reference, the other stabbing, a man named Oscar Solarzano was arrested in October of last year and charged with a misdemeanor carrying a concealed weapon. And then in December, was accused of stabbing and injuring a man on a light rail train here in Charlotte. He's been charged with felony counts of attempted first-degree murder, assault with a deadly weapon, inflicting serious injury, and breaking into a vehicle, that vehicle being the light rail train, because I guess he didn't buy a ticket. I don't know. Will your office be prosecuting this case, too?
We've already brought charges in that case. No one died in that case, fortunately, but the knife came millimeters away from the central artery in the heart. It could be a very different case. The other thing about the light rail is after that stabbing happened, they weren't at a stop. And so everyone was on that rail car trapped in there. The doors were closed. They had a guy with a knife who had just stabbed somebody. That's the terrorism I'm talking about, and that's why we're going to be there from those cases.
Russ Ferguson's with us. He is the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, and we will continue in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Russ Ferguson, U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, in the job since March and officially sworn in after being confirmed by the Senate in December on Christmas Eve. As a U.S. attorney, you work for the Department of Justice. Many people consider the Trump administration to be lawless and at the very least, to be testing the limits of constitutional authority of the executive branch. And he runs, the president runs the Department of Justice. It falls under the executive branch, but it has been independent or allegedly independent up until recently. How difficult is it for a Duke University graduate and a graduate of the Georgetown University Law Center to work for such an administration and one in which they appeared to be turning the Department of Justice into Donald Trump's personal law firm?
Well, everything's difficult for a Duke University graduate, so it's difficult. But, you know, I was worried about that coming into the job because you do see a lot of press about that, and I have found it to not be the case at all. I have been in this job since March. I have never once gotten a call from the White House. I very rarely get a call from Maine Justice. And if I do, it's usually for advice on a case in a different district, like the woman who was set on fire on a train in Chicago. I got a call saying, well, how did you do the train case in Charlotte? For the most part, we're doing our job. They trust me to be the U.S. attorney here to bring the cases we want to bring. Obviously, we've shifted priorities a little bit. We're focused on gangs, cartels, violent crime, the crimes that keep you up at night, transit, things like that. But I've been left alone to do my job. I have great prosecutors in my office that have been there for decades, and they're doing the same job they were doing decades ago.
But you're part of the Department of Justice.
Correct, yes.
And your office is a branch of the Department of Justice.
Sure.
And right now, the Justice Department is flaunting a recently passed law mandating the release of the Epstein files. That law ordered the department to release those files by December 19th. Of last year. They missed the deadline. The law also says, quote, no record shall be withheld, delayed, or redacted on the basis of embarrassment, reputational harm, or political sensitivity, including to any government official, public figure, or foreign dignitary. That hasn't happened, and much of what has been released has been heavily redacted without explanation, and that's also in the law. If you're going to redact something, tell us why. You redacted it. What's your opinion of how the Department of Justice is operating in this manner?
And this is my opinion because I obviously have nothing to do with the Epstein files or that. But I think that law comes into conflict with some other laws. And a lot of those laws protect victims and require that victims be redacted. And giving a timeline with 2 million documents to release and trying to comply with those victim laws, I think is very
difficult.
They've
had these documents for years.
They've had these for years, but the law to release them is very recently.
And Pam Bondi has said, it's on my desk, we're releasing them. And then suddenly she's not doing that.
Well, and a lot of them are grand jury files. She's twice gone to the court asking for permission to release them. The court first said no, so she was following a court order not to release those files. So, I think there's a tension between laws here, but I think they will be released and that law will be followed.
Why do you have confidence in that?
Well, I obviously have nothing to do with this, but as someone who works for the Department of Justice, I see every day there is a desire to comply with the law as Congress passes it, and I think that's what they'll do.
And you think they will?
I do.
Because if they don't, why should any of us obey any law?
I think that's fair. We got to hold government just as accountable as you hold the people, and I guarantee you Congress will hold the Department of Justice accountable if they don't comply with that law.
Why do you believe that? They haven't held this administration accountable to anything.
Well, they passed that law, and I think Congress has done a whole lot of oversight of this administration. I mean, we hear things about Donald Trump all the time that Congress has a problem with. They're passing laws in response to it. They're holding nominations in response to it. I mean, Congress is Article I of the Constitution. They have the real power here. If they want to exercise it and they think there's a problem, they will.
Russ, are you sleepwalking through history?
I'm right here in the present day.
And you're saying that with a straight face?
With a straight face, yes. I think that Congress has a lot of power, and they're choosing to exercise it where they want. Now, don't get me wrong. Congress runs for office every 2 years. Are they out there saying, we're going to do this and we're going to do that, where there's not an actual legal problem? Sure, maybe. But where there is, they're taking action.
You're also working for an administration that is going after a United States senator for advising military servicemen and women to not break the law. And yesterday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said he had formally censured Arizona Senator Mark Kelly and is considering whether to reduce his rank in retirement. Hegseth says that Kelly has made, quote, seditious statements when he and five other Democrats reminded U.S. troops that they can disobey illegal orders. And they used the language in the Military Code of Justice, if I've got that correct. What's your legal take on that?
And that's a Department of Defense process, so I don't know a whole lot about it. I do think the Defense Department has to be very careful that orders are carried out. It's a hierarchical system for a reason. They can't have line troops making their own decisions. There has to be one general making the decisions. So I think it's a good process for the Defense Department to undertake. I understand there is due process here. I don't know at the end of the day if Senator Kelly will be found to have done something wrong or not. But it is a total Defense Department process. He has not been indicted in federal court or anything like that.
But would it go to the courts at some point? I mean, or would he have to force it to go to the courts?
That's a good question. I don't know a whole lot about Defense Department military procedures. I imagine he could file something in federal court if he wanted to, but I believe he will also have process in the military system.
And if he did file in federal court, would the Department of Justice be on the other side of that case, or would it be the Defense Department on the other side of that case?
It depends on how he files it. If he filed it against the United States, then the Department of Justice would represent the United States. If he files it against Secretary Hegseth, for example, in his personal capacity, Secretary Hegseth would be on the other side. If it's an official capacity, then the Department of Justice would probably represent.
The administration also spent weeks bombing boats in the Caribbean and killing those on board who were allegedly involved in drug trafficking without providing a shred of evidence that that's what they were involved in. And over the weekend, of course, we entered the sovereign nation and removed its leader. Nicolas Maduro and his wife from Venezuela brought him to the U.S. And yesterday, we indicted him on drug trafficking charges. Again, from your perspective as an attorney, is that legal, either under the U.S. Constitution or under international law? Is that legal? Can we just go in and take somebody out?
You know, that is probably governed by international treaties and the law of war and all of that. The Department of Justice does have extraterritorial jurisdiction, especially for drug crimes coming from other places. And you know, what's interesting about this is they did not grab him out, stick him in Guantanamo in a court-martial. They brought him to a United States court, mm-hmm. to New York, where mm-hmm. he would get a very fair jury and a Clinton-appointed judge who will look after his rights. So I think he's getting all the process that he has, more process than he has a right to, I think.
How would the Department of Justice view this if the shoe were on the other foot, if Vladimir Putin came and extracted Donald Trump out of our country?
Well, I think it depends. I think we'd probably see that as an act of war. And we would retaliate appropriately. But it's funny that the people of Venezuela don't see it that way. And President Maduro was
Some
not the president of Venezuela.
No, he was not the president of Venezuela legally. But at one point we recognized him. And in fact, there's a problem with the indictment, as I understand it, that in one part of the indictment we call him the president of Venezuela. And in another part of the indictment we say he's not the president because he's not there. He tainted the election. So which is it?
And he's not the president.
And does that present a problem in the courts when the indictment is in conflict with itself?
It could. I don't think it will in this case because it's not an element of the crime that he's a president of Venezuela or not. He's being charged as the head of a cartel, and the head of a cartel will face justice in the United States Justice System.
Okay. Investigations have turned up instances of possible fraud at daycare centers in Minnesota, which appear, if true, to be part of a larger problem involving how COVID-related recovery money has been used by various organizations in that state. And, of course, yesterday, the governor of that state decided not to run for re-election. That's not an admission of fault, of guilt, but he removed himself from what's going to be a contentious election as a result of this. But fraud involving COVID is not relegated simply to Minnesota. It's happening all over the country, and your office has been going after that in this state against people who allegedly received millions of dollars in COVID relief money to which they were not entitled. In fact, it's $280 billion, I think, the last figure that I saw. Two of those accused were sentenced last April. Are there other cases ongoing in this state at the moment?
Yes, we've had a whole lot of fraud cases related to COVID-19. And part of the reason for that is because there was a whole lot of money given out during COVID-19. And we've had cases, we've attacked them two different ways. We've had some criminal prosecutions like you just talked about. But we've also had some cases where we went after them civilly and recovered the money and maybe a penalty. And the reason for that is because right after COVID, the regulations were not extremely clear on all of these. Now, there were some people you look at and you say, well, you were intending to commit a crime there. If you said you were operating a daycare center and you weren't, you were intending to commit a crime. Other people where you had a foreign company, you had a domestic subsidiary, maybe they didn't understand the rules. We've recovered the money for the taxpayer. We've recovered a penalty, but we haven't sent those people to jail. But we've had a large number of COVID-19 fraud cases. And we always have government fraud cases. I mean, we have healthcare fraud cases every day. So wherever there is federal funding, there is federal fraud.
Is that because there's something wrong with the system? We don't have enough people to keep tabs on what's going on with all this money floating around the country? Or is there something else going on here?
Well, I mean, the thing about fraud is it's people trying to get around the system.
Yeah.
And so there's always going to be fraud where there is money, and particularly where there's public money. And so all we can do is try to find it in the first place, of course, but where people are going to lie to the government to get money, we prosecute them afterwards.
Is it difficult to define what constitutes fraud in most of these cases? I mean, is the line clear or is it kind of blurry?
Fraud is very clear. Okay. Fraud, you know, it requires criminal intent. You know that someone was doing something they shouldn't have done, and we usually have evidence of that. If you're creating a fake document, then you're committing fraud. Where there is some of what you're talking about, where I didn't understand the regulation or I didn't know or we can't, and like you said, we bring airtight cases. So if we can't prove fraud, we will sue to get the money back.
So the day you were here in May,
yeah.
I believe, was the day a federal grand jury returned a criminal indictment charging former Charlotte City Councilwoman Tijuana Brown and her daughters with wire fraud conspiracy and wire fraud in connection with fraudulent applications filed to falsely obtain COVID pandemic relief funds. She has, Ms. Brown has, insisted from the very beginning that she is not guilty of those charges and that she, in fact, paid back whatever money you allege she took fraudulently, and that she's accused of misappropriating. Where does that case stand today?
Yeah, that was indicted the day I was here last time, so full circle moment. That case is still pending, and those are, of course, all still allegations. In those white-collar cases, you do see the defendants asking for more time a lot because they need to go through the documents and build their case, and I think the defendants asked for a continuance recently, so that case is continuing to be prosecuted, but has not gone to trial yet.
I mean, you mentioned that sometimes a defendant will say, well, I didn't know that I was doing anything wrong, and that changes the complexion of the case, essentially.
Sure.
And is that the case here? Because she paid back the money, she says.
Well, and you know, I don't want to say too much about a case that's pending
right.
and obtain a jury or anything, but paying back the money to me is evidence of consciousness of guilt. Why would you pay back money if you didn't owe it back? I also think there were documents here that were created and made, at least that's the allegations. So I don't think this is a case where there was a misunderstanding.
Charlotte community activist Cedric Dean is also the subject of an ongoing federal investigation, and your office has accused him of running a massive Medicaid fraud scheme, including improperly billing Medicaid millions of dollars over a 10-month period using medical or Medicaid ID numbers from vulnerable people in the community, people living in homeless shelters and halfway houses and places like that. In October, raids were conducted on three of the properties that are linked to Mr. Dean. He has not yet, to my knowledge, been federally charged, nor has he been indicted. What's the status of that?
Yeah, he has not been charged yet, so we haven't accused Mr. Dean of anything.
Okay.
The only reason that investigation is even public is because we executed a search warrant on his home. So that is an investigation. We have investigations all the time, and obviously we have probable cause to search, so there is some standard there, but we have investigations all the time. We decide whether to charge. In a lot of cases, we decide not to, depending on the outcome of that investigation. So we'll see where the facts unfold on that one.
Meanwhile, a heavy black cloud is hanging over Mr. Dean. So how do you feel pressure to be expedient in this situation?
Absolutely, especially after it becomes public. And something that the Justice Department did not do under the prior administration that we're definitely doing under this administration is telling people when their investigations end. Because we've had a lot of, especially white-collar like this, prosecutions where the Justice Department closes the investigation internally but never tells the defendant that, never clears their name.
Why?
And we've stopped doing that. I don't know why. I don't think that's fair to do to anyone. If we find out that someone has not committed a crime or we can't prove they've committed a crime, we ought to clear them.
Was that particular to Merrick Garland's Justice Department, or was it common practice prior to his tenure?
It was very common in his Justice Department. I'm sure it happened before that. I think sometimes it's because, you know, it lays on a desk or goes on a back burner and mm-hmm. isn't paid attention to. I think also sometimes there are prosecutors that really believe someone committed a crime, but they can't prove it. And so it's a little justice to them to keep the person on the hook. But I don't think that's right, and we've stopped doing it.
There's also a federal investigation into how North Carolina's DMV was registering people to vote. And as I understand it, your investigation found that some people who were registered to vote should not have been registered to vote because they weren't citizens. What's the story there, and what is likely to change at the DMV as a result of what you discovered?
Yeah, and what we found, we had individuals that were brought to us by law enforcement that had registered to vote and should not have voted. And in that investigation, we found that they didn't mean to register to vote. In fact, one woman who spoke only Spanish brought her English-speaking husband, who told the DMV examiner multiple times, she cannot register to vote, she is not a citizen. All these people are lawfully here, but not a citizen, so they can't vote. And of course, the same is true for felons and minors and other individuals are not eligible to vote. And so that's a problem. In some years, 80% of people who register to vote register to vote for the DMV. So if they don't have an airtight system, it's a problem for our election rolls and for making people feel secure in our elections. So, and I need to give the DMV some credit. I met with Commissioner Tine about this. He was brand new. I said, this is a problem. He said, we have some really outdated computer systems. We're relying on our examiners. Obviously, things slipped through the cracks. And we worked together and came up with a plan to fix it. He's retrained his examiners. He's put some stops in the system. They're trying to get a new computer system. They've put notices up to their examiners. They're trying to bring in interpreters for people who don't speak English. Because what happens? You've been to the DMV. You get a signature block on the page. You sign. You want to get out of there as fast as you can. And that's what happens. But we're hoping to fix it so our voter rolls are
safe. I think I was at the DMV last November. I think I'm still there. I don't think I've left.
You're still in line.
Russ Ferguson, U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. Thank you so much for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.